First thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away, just to spend them with you. If I could make days last forever, if words could make wishes come true, I'd save every day like a treasure, and then again I would spend them with you. But there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do once you find them. I've looked around enough to know that you're the one I want to go through time with. If I had a box just for wishes and dreams that had never come true, the box would be empty except for the memory of how they were answered by you. But there never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do once you find them. Looked around enough to know you're the one I want to go through time.
Good morning and welcome to Language to Language. This is your host, Woody. In Haida, Kaunsunga Hinudi Kya Ang, Tsetlanas Hat Ayudi Ijim, Kachakas Diok Alakn, Dr. Woodrow Morrison Jr. BAJD Hinuya Ats Hat Ay Kilt Kya Ang. In Haida, I'm called Kaunsunga. Kaunsunga is somebody who brings a special day. Tsetlanas Hat Ayudi Ijim, I am of the Haida Tsetlanas, or Two-Headed Eagle clan, crest. Kachakas Diokwalagn, I'm of the eagle half of the Haida population. In English, I am Dr. Woodrow Morrison, Jr., BAJD. Anyway, that out of the way, each week when I come in here, it's the way our storytelling happens. We never know which story we're going to tell. It all depends on how we feel, what we see, what's happening, and so, but I did bring something in because it's something that's current and something that's very important to me personally. It's an article in Saturday's Globe and Mail called Chief Justice Resets the Native Question. It's in Section A6 of the Globe and Mail, Saturday, May 20th, 2015. McLaughlin's comment on cultural genocide is lauded as a turning point in both jurisprudence and popular views of Canadian history. And I'll read just a little bit from it. A former chief executive officer with the Canadian Jewish Congress says this country committed genocide, not merely cultural genocide. Among other things, Bernie Faber cites the work of University of Regina professor James Dachuk, who published the 2013 book Clearing the Plains, Disease, Politics of Starvation, and the Loss of Aboriginal Life, asserting that Prime Minister John A. Macdonald had deliberate policy of starving the Plains Indians. The book won an award named after Macdonald for the Canadian Historical Association. I say this as a child of Holocaust survivors, Mr. Faber said in an interview. My father was the only Jewish survivor in that village, of his village. I was brought up in that shadow and understand that what that pain is all about. Those who tell Aboriginals to move on, do not understand that until you confront it and admit it, you can't even start to heal, and we're not even there yet. Jim Miller, a professor emeritus of history at the University of Saskatchewan, said that Canada did not commit genocide. In quotes, "We relied on Aboriginal people for too many things," said MacDonald. Said MacDonald did not attempt to eradicate Plains Indians. But in 1870s and 80s, the government did, in quotes, "use food as a weapon." They deliberately cut back rations from those who were holdouts to treaties, and the people died as a result. He said Chief Justice McLaughlin's use of the term cultural genocide is accurate and a turning point for Canada. It gives a seal of approval and endorsement from a very senior, prominent, respected figure in public life in Canada to an interpretation of Canadian history that many people have resisted until now. We've had kind of a rosy picture of ourselves, mainly by contrasting ourselves with the Americans who followed military policies toward Western First Nations in the late 19th century. We all convinced ourselves as a people that our handling of Aboriginal affairs was much better, perhaps even beneficent. He called her comments entirely appropriate. She didn't make partisan comments, she didn't comment on contemporary government policy, and she was in a position to speak authoritatively, having spent months and years working on the history of cases like the Delgamuukw or the recent Tsleil-Waututh decision. The Chief Justice's speech was troubling for Emmett McFarland, a political science professor at the University of Waterloo. In quotes, "What troubles me a little bit is that the court will continue to face cases where the historical perspective is deeply relevant to Indigenous rights and land title claims," he said, unquote. He said the legal community is deferential to Chief Justice McLaughlin in the point of hero worship and unlikely to criticize her. Gerald Shapur, a Calgary constitutional lawyer, said Chief Justice McLaughlin's comments were not controversial but a reflection of widely accepted fact, implicitly acknowledged by Prime Minister Stephen Harper in his 2008 apology to Aboriginal peoples for the abuses of the residential schools. Phil Fontaine, a former national chief, said the Chief Justice's assertion is, in quotes, "a very clear signal to government in all jurisdictions that Indigenous people face unique challenges and that governments have to be more responsive to meeting those challenges." She's also calling out to Canadians that what is needed is a greater effort in terms of education and information about our place in Canada, unquote. I was born and raised in Alaska, which is part of the United States, and also went to the boarding schools, well, day school, Indian day school in the village, and then was sent off. I spent 2 years in a Presbyterian-run residential school, and then graduated from one that was run by Indian Affairs. Then later attended another residential school in Lawrence, Kansas, called Haskell Institute. Today is a four-year university. And there were students there from representing 52 tribes from 35 states. And the stories I've read and listened to of the experiences here in Canada, we had our own stories, but nothing as horrendous as what happened here. Chief Justice McLaughlin is saying that, I think the number was somewhere around 6,000 children died in those schools. I think they left one zero off. It should have been more like 60,000. There was anywhere from 60 to 75% attrition rate of people's children dying in those schools. And it's hard to tell how many exactly, because no records were kept of the deaths, or there are very few. In many cases, children died and the parents were never even informed. I was watching a video where a woman was talking about, no, it was a play called The Body Indian. Oh, no, that's another one. This one is called God and the Indian. And in it, the woman confronting a Catholic bishop or a bishop talked about how her brother died at that school where she was also a student. And she didn't find out until about 2 weeks after his death that he had died. And the parents weren't even notified until 2 years later, I believe it was. And when she told her parents what happened, they blamed her for not looking out for her little brother. And so that's what happens, is you keep blaming the victims. In the United States, yes, there were military incursions. Nothing is talked about all the chiefs and people that were hanged here in Canada. We tend to cover that all up because, you know, we're good Christians. The horrible part of this is that not only does Canada not teach anything about its own history, but they did something worse than killing the people. They took away the reason to be alive. That's why there's so many suicides. You take away a life and a style, a culture, and don't replace it with anything except violence. And you take a look at Western civilization. It's been a history of nothing but wars, of killing. And the things that were done to Native people here, it's not unique. The church murdered, tortured, possibly millions in her Inquisition, trying to find heretics. When you take a look at the wars that have been fought, how many millions of people have been killed for what? For pecuniary gain. They want something that belongs to somebody else. I've been reading a series of historic novels by a man named Jack White, W-H-Y-T-E. And one I'm reading right now is called The Sorcerer Metamorphosis. In this series of books, Jack White is creating a fictional account of the birth, life, of factors leading up to the birth, life, and death of King Arthur, and also of Merlin. Although it's fictional about how King Arthur came into being, the history that he writes about isn't. The British Isles, after they were taken over by the Romans, it seemed like they had stopped fighting for a long time, but then it started again. So that killing and killing and killing of each other over farmland or loot, women, seems to never stop. And one of the things I was reading in his books is a discussion of a character who was excommunicated, I guess is what it was. He was declared a heretic because of what he was teaching about the Bible and about Christianity. And I thought it was something I could probably, I was just looking at the pager to see what those viewpoints were. There were five or six. I'm kind of fumbling here a bit because I lost the page here. I'll find it again. We'll take a break in a little bit and I'll look through and find it. But in the meantime, one of the other things he wrote that I thought was quite interesting was he was talking about liars, about his character who became Merlin was caught in a lie. And it was very simple. He was just lying about where his cousin might be. And anyway, the uncle took him severely to task over the lie, emphasizing and reiterating that lying consistently contains its own punishments, feeding upon itself to the point at which the liar loses all respect and credibility. He kept coming back to the point for weeks until I grew hardly sick of it. This is from page 204 of Jack White's The Sorcerer. I suppose I should be a bit more precise in citing where this is coming from. It's published by the Penguin Company, and copyright Jack White, 1997, all rights reserved, and manufactured in Canada. And this is page 204. And then he goes on to say, he concluded the lesson by asking me if I knew what the liar's tragedy was. He insisted that I think about the question and find an answer to it. So I thought and I thought. Finally, I thought I knew the answer. Well, Uncle of ours asked me, I think once a man becomes a really bad liar, a habitual liar, then his tragedy must be that no matter what he says, no one will ever believe him. My uncle nodded. That is really awful, isn't it? Would you like to be in that situation? No. No, nor would I. To go through life knowing that no one will believe you about anything must be truly terrible. But you know, Kay, that is not the liar's tragedy. The liar's tragedy is far, far worse. I gazed at him wide-eyed. How, Uncle? What could be worse than that? This, Kay, the real tragedy of the liar is that he can never believe anyone else. So I think that's probably what has happened, is that we have people in governments who are lying about so many things, is that when they hear the truth, they won't believe it either. They don't believe anybody themselves. So when you lie about your own history, you don't believe anybody else's versions of history, because it's so difficult to know what the possible truth might have been. Anyway, that's something that's really been on my mind, is this whole thing about the residential schools and what happened. I see where there was a man named Hayden, starred in a television reality show called Son of a Gun. Anyway, I see in the newspaper yesterday that he's been accused and charged with sexually abusing adolescent girls. And so I put on Facebook, you know, I asked people what their comments might be about that. And one of the things that I pointed out was that this person has not been convicted. He's merely been charged. So until there is a conviction, there's still the assumption of innocence. And that's one of the real difficult parts of Aboriginal life, is that in our cultures, there is no concept for guilty or not guilty. It's whether you did it or not, whether you committed the act or not. And so that's a much more difficult test to overcome, especially if someone saw you or something you admitted to. And simply throwing yourself on the mercy of the court is not an option. So when we look at these things and we look at what's going on here in Canada, and we keep pointing to the United States, we're not as bad as they are. When I first came to Canada, I commented on a couple of shootings that took place here in Vancouver. And immediately, I was told, well, we're not as bad as the Americans. Well, seeing how many shootings we're getting, say, in Surrey and other places here in the city, as compared to what it was when I came here to Canada 25 years ago, came to Vancouver 25 years ago, how bad do we have to get before we'll admit we have a problem? And that's my point. Well, anyway, something that I'm more interested in, I guess you might say I'm not what you call a do-gooder. I'm not out to change the world or to be the accuser of all the terrible things people are doing. My job is to pass on history. Not that which is written in the books, but that which was taught to me in the oral tradition. And the teaching of oral history is very, very different from what I've read about it, by what scholars have written, people have gotten their PhDs on. And the process that I went through, and other men and women I've had the opportunity to talk with, theirs was very, our experiences are very, very similar, even though we come from widely different points on the planet. It was a very vigorous or rigorous process that began with early childhood. Mine began when I was 3 years of age. It might have begun earlier, but when World War II came along, I was born in 1941, and war came in December of that year. And in the fall of 1942, the Japanese had invaded the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. So my Cherokee grandfather went to Alaska, and he got my mother and I. And we traveled by steamship from Alaska to Seattle, and then by troop train from there to San Bernardino, California. And we lived in Redlands, I believe it was, or Yucaipa, California, during most of the war. And then in 1944, the spring of 1944, we moved back. So it was in 1944 when my grandfather took me to the old men and they started teaching me. So maybe they would have started earlier, but I wasn't there. So anyway, when we talk about history, we're not talking about the way European record about empires and politics and wars and economies. Our history is really more about the relationship between the natural world and all of the living things. See, we don't separate animate from inanimate. Everything is. Everything has a spirit. So simply because it's a rock doesn't mean it doesn't have a spirit, because it doesn't go anywhere. Same with a tree. It has a spirit also. It has a force in it. So when the history is taught, we talk about the relationship between us and all those things. And also, our history, we look at history from the opposite direction from that of Western scholars, or even from the Eastern scholars, I would assume. I haven't spent any time researching to find out. But I was visiting with a Dr. Graham Smith. He's Maori from New Zealand. He was out here at UBC, and he was running a program focused on generating more Aboriginal people getting PhDs. And at one point I was going to apply for a program for a PhD in oral history. But after having read some of the literature, I decided against it. But anyway, we were talking about time, and when he said to me that in Maori, the past is in front of me, I can see it. The future is behind me, I can't see it. It's like I'm standing in a river, and time is coming to me. I'm not going anywhere. Whatever comes into view, I have to deal with right at that moment, because it will never be there again. And when he was talking about that, I knew what he was saying. All saying haida chiankano, it's true. It's true. Because I was taught essentially the same thing with slightly different words. When I use the term hagui is sort of, it's over there. I can see it from here. So when we talk about the farther past, we'll say Awash Agui, which could have been, say, before the last ice age. But then if we talk about, or we'll say it's the period since the ice age, so if it was before the ice age, then we call it Wajguayun Kwangum. And so that's rather than just counting years in terms of, I mean, the passage of time in years, we count it in cycles. One cycle is approximately 5,200 years. And these cycles run in sets of five. So five cycles would be 26,000 years. And 26,000 years ago is when the last ice age began. And then there was another one that reached full coverage, I guess you might say, 60,000 years ago. But it began 15 cycles ago, which was 78,000 years ago. And 78,000 years ago, a supervolcano exploded somewhere around somewhere in Indonesia. And in our history, it says the sky was covered with a blanket of soot and dirt, and you couldn't see the sky for a long time. And that brought about a nuclear winter. History tells of seeing the first snowflakes. And so that's the way we look at history, is in terms of sort of historical events. One that sort of the inner period was called Gishlit. Gishlit is somewhere between, well, the farthest one away is called Tladlu Hagui, sort of like it was over the horizon. Something took place before we came into being as humans. It was called Tladla Hagui. We know about it because Raven told us. And so the time between Watsqua Hagui and Kwangum and Tladlu Hagui is called Gishlit, or the mythical time. That's when the tide came in. That's when our history says that the flood occurred. So anyway, we can look at time in terms of the clock, or we can look at time in many other ways. I have friends from the Mayan, but they call themselves Mam, and a man who was referred to as being Aztecan, but he told me the correct term for that, but I don't remember it. And so they talk about time and they have many different calendars. One of them is a 20-day calendar that runs for 13 months. And a 20-day calendar works out to be the gestation period of a human, 270 days, something like that. And our lunar calendar is 364 days, 13 28-day months with one extra day. And that's the day when anything is possible. That's when the star child, the star woman, well, it said the other way, this person with no status, sort of like a slave, but it just means person with no lineage, receives this wife that comes from the stars. So anyway, we'll take a break here and see if we can play a little bit more music. I think it's 5 o'clock world. And then maybe a PSA.
Hey CITR listeners, thank you again for your continuing support. Because of your generous donations and assistance, CITR rose over $42,000 for our annual fund drive. We'd also like to give thanks to our many sponsors. These sponsors donated a substantial amount to CITR's fund drive through prizes which have found their way into the hands of our listeners. CITR thanks Live Nation, Blueprint Events, Vancouver Folk Music Festival, Sub Pop Records, Random House, Rogue Folk Club, Sled Island, Future Noise Limited, Mute Records, Herschel Supply Company, Timber Concerts, and all those who gave their generous support. CITR thanks you. Thank you.
Look at that guy's beard. What's he got on his head?
Hey, buddy, you don't want your type here.
Yeah, what are you, some kind of terrorist?
Hey, be nice, okay? This bus is a safe harbor. This man deserves respect, doesn't everybody?
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for All. Pass it on.
Anyway, that's a 5 o'clock. That's a 5 o'clock world. I don't know if you've noticed or not, but I tend to pick songs that deal with time. And anyway, I looked through the book I was mentioning earlier about The Sorcerer, Metamorphosis by Jack White, and in it, a man named Pelagius, I guess, P-E-L-A-G-I-U-S. I-U-S, yeah, P-E-L-A-G-I-U-S. He was declared a heretic and I guess excommunicated from the Catholic Church for his teachings. And so this is around 400 AD, and a bishop is talking about him. He said, "I knew him when I was very young, and I agree very well. 6 points Pelagius made, and I shall keep them brief. Each of them bore on one or both of two central tenets of the Christian Church. The original sin of Adam, and a divine gift of grace. Bear in mind, though, we speak of heresy here, so do not become seduced." As he began to speak, he enumerated the points he made with his fingers, starting with the little finger of his right hand. One, and first above all, Pelagius averred that life is inseparable from death. He taught that even Adam had not sinned. Even if Adam had not sinned, he would have died. Two, and even more seditious, he maintained that Adam's sin was personal. It harmed only Adam himself and not the entire human race. In case number 3, which is based upon number 2, he claimed that newborn children are in a state of innocence as was Adam before his fall. For, perhaps the most unacceptable of all his claims, he asserts that the whole human race neither dies through Adam's sin or death, nor rises again through the resurrection of our beloved Christus. 5. He paused before starting this point, and I waited holding my breath. Pelagius would have us all believe that the ancient Hebrew writings, the Old Testament, containing the laws of Moses, are a sure guide to heaven as are the Gospels. I waited for him to continue, but he seemed lost in thought, apparently upon the latter point, which of all the five had meant the least to me. Finally, I cleared my throat. And 6? What? You said there's 6 points, you gave me only 5. Oh, forgive me, let me see, 6. Pelagius swore that even before the advent of Christ, there were men who were without sin. I sat back quickly, resting my shoulders against the cold wall and breathing deeply. The last point had hit home unpleasantly to me. I had heard it spoken, although differently phrased, by my father. He had been taught by Bishop Alaric that even before Christ and his redemption, good and noble men had known the difference between right and wrong, between good and evil. And there was much difference between the two versions of thought. I realized for the first time since my journey of so many years earlier, I found myself unwilling to peer into the metaphysical abyss that suddenly yawned in front of me. Men, in particular clerics, I recall again, had infinite capacity for splitting hairs of meaning. The bishop, however, had noticed nothing of my reaction and continued speaking. So, anyway, these points in here, what he talks about, when Pelagius said that life and death are inseparable, you know, life is inseparable from death, that it's part of a process, and he taught that even if Adam hadn't sinned, he would have died. And the church is denying that. It says death and dying came about because of Adam's sin. And so this man also was saying that children were born innocent. And the church is saying no. Because of their original sin, the children are condemned to death. So when you see, excuse me, those are the kinds of teachings that was beaten into the children's heads in these residential schools, that our concept of sharing, of trusting, of cooperating and giving back were heresy. They were against the church. When I wanted to do the ceremony, I was planning on doing a ceremony for women called Dancing Under the Paddle. One said that that the names of the elders I'd cited would not have done that because they were devout Christians. They didn't believe in ceremony. So that stems right from those kinds of teachings. That's what he writes of in that book. And then what I was saying earlier too about Canadians living with rose-colored glasses when they look at our history. I'm curious as to how will history record what's going on now. We're blaming the terrorists for coming to Canada and threatening to blow up things and shoot people when we're giving them ample reason to do it. We can use the term surgical bombing, but a slip of the knife here and a slip of the knife there, a lot of collateral damage. And what really bothers me more, one of my concerns about all the stuff that's been happening in the Middle East, I think it's around Iran somewhere where there's a herd of antelope, I believe it was, that were endangered, and over 100,000 of them just died. And we had that happen in the United States when a whole bunch of sheep died. Well, they died because somebody was testing a nerve gas and it got away. It got into the wind and it wiped out some flocks of sheep. But you take a look at just the millions of tons of explosives that have gone off in that part of the world, and you see in the news clips. Men firing weapons, not even looking where they're firing, they're just firing. So there's billions of bullets laying out on the ground out there. And many of them are depleted uranium, many of them have copper, many of them have lead. So all this stuff out there, and what kind of a future is that leaving for the generations to come behind us? So anyway, when I talk about history, the history I'm talking about in Ida has nothing to do with those things. In natural history, this is the way I wrote it. A person called a tide watcher sits on the what we call a Aditi. This is the uplands above the tide. The eyes open, the tide is high, and it starts to fall, to ebb. Things begin to appear from under the water. Each of those things is an opportunity that has to be taken at that moment, because it will never be there again. The tide keeps going out until it reaches a certain place. Maybe it's the turning of an era, or the shift of a cycle, the beginning of another revolution or something like that, they say. The tide watcher's eyes close, goes into the dream time, and the balance is restored. The tide watcher's eyes open, and it begins to watch again. As the tide drops, things appear from under the water again. They look the same as they did last time, but they are different. They are never the same twice. Each time this happens, each cycle, we watch to see what's coming the next time. Sometimes there's a storm, sometimes an earthquake. Something disrupts the order of things the way they look, they say. If we watch and record enough cycles, it gets to where we can almost predict what's going to come next. But you really can't, because we don't know if something's going to change it or something has changed it. The only things that can change that history are natural things like earthquakes, volcanoes, meteors, storms, things like that, they say. Where human history is different, we can change it. We can change how things turn out by the decisions we make this time. In other words, the world that I'm living in right now is that was created by my grandparents' generation, the decisions they made, the things they chose to do. And now my grandchildren are only living in the world I created. So if we know that, maybe we can make something different. So we have to pay attention not only to physical history, to the things that happen, like the unchanging seasons, the salmon runs, how the salmon come and go. We watch clams, animals, we watch birds, because each of those things affect how we live. We have to be careful because our decisions affect the lives of those other things too. We have to be aware of the balance. If you plan for something, it's like you're aiming at a thing in your mind. You can't see the target you think you want to hit. You point your arrow or your mind towards it and you shoot at it. Since the target is in the future, you can't see where you hit until you get to it. Then you know how close you came to the thing you were aiming for, and if it was the right thing. If we miss or learn we're going to miss, we can alter our aim. However, our time footprint is at least 5,200 years wide, so that gives us time to watch and see what's happening and make adjustments. Thus, I've always been out of step because the others see their place in the universe is bounded by hours, minutes, seconds, even nanoseconds. My world consists of 5,200-year time footprints, hence I'm always aware that whatever I say or do could impact humanity for at least 5,200 years. As a result, my concerns are not for myself or even for my children or grandchildren, except how to reduce the possibilities for unpleasant experiences and to enhance the possibilities for happy experiences. A friend and relative, when reacting to situations or events, was prone to saying, 100 years from now, who's going to know the difference? If we're to improve the human condition and maintain the balance or the integrity of the soul, we have to consider what we're doing in terms of more than just for ourselves. And so there are a group of, well, not ex- I won't say a group because it's not an organization of any sort, but it's a collection of individuals who've been trained in this kind of history the way, very much the same as mine. And so we're talking about those things. You take a look at the floods that are hitting Texas and Oklahoma and the tornadoes and hurricanes, the ocean temperature moving, coming from Alaska down this way is above normal, it's warm. So all these things are beginning to happen, and we humans like to think that we can control things. When you see two things, snow or rain, you realize how puny our technology is. We can't, you know, we've been trying. If you go back to the 1940s, the United States, Canada, Great Britain, China, Russia, well, the Soviet Union, India, and others have been doing extensive cloud seeding for at least the last 50 years. What they're trying to do is protect their crops, and also how do we control the weather? If you can control the weather, you can control the world militarily. So now we're getting the areas where we get our food, we're either getting floods or droughts. California, a major food producer, is now experiencing severe drought. I think Oregon is also, and you look at places across the United States and down into Texas, and you've got floods. You got weather that's colder in some places than before, and places like this where our winter was the warmest we've had in a long time. So those are the things that we look at when we look at our history. And we're not so arrogant that we think we can stop this change. What we can do is we can provide for the survival of the human species. But it's not by storing canned goods or dried foods or guns, building underground shelters. No, it's in human relations where we have to lean on each other. It's sort of like I say, the illustration between having a glove on your hand in minus 70 degree weather and what can possibly happen to your fingers. They freeze. Whereas with a mitten, they probably won't, because each finger is giving its heat to the other, and neither is keeping score. I was saying, you know, you owe me one. No, this is different. And also, our economy is based on scarcity. The more scarce something, the higher the price. I was just looking at the gas prices this morning. $1.349 a liter. If you multiply that by 3.8, which are the number of gallons in a liter, and you'll find that we're paying probably $2 a gallon more for our gasoline than is the Americans. And none of our taxes for our gasoline goes to doing something for transportation, like fixing roads, improving infrastructure, anything. I don't know where it all goes. But anyway, that's not the point. The point is, we're not planning for these changes. I work with families, and one of the problems that many families have in raising children is that they don't take into consideration that my children are growing, they're changing, they're going to get older, they're going to develop their own personalities, their own needs, even their own physical appearance. But we want to keep them the way they are, because in order to treat them differently, we have to change. But how are we going to change? You know, to change my point of view. So instead of trying to find out and try to understand the changes our children are undergoing, we simply make more and more rules. Well, in residential schools, clothespins were put on people's tongues for speaking their language. Some were burned, branded. Some had lye soap put in their mouths. All sorts of things like that. Reinforcement, negative reinforcement to tell everybody whatever you're doing is bad, wrong, dirty, and evil. So there was no positive reinforcement. So when we work with families, working with their children, instead of continuing to find fault and trying to reshape or shape our children into our own image, we teach people how to make compliments, to give compliments, and to not use a compliment as a lead-in to a sermon, or even of a criticism. Instead of saying, you didn't do this, or you didn't do that, or you, we change it around to I feel so frustrated when I find a shirt I loaned you laying on the floor. I want you to go in there and pick it up and hang it properly right now. So, you don't add all the other things that this person has done wrong. Just, I am very upset because of that one thing. Here's how we fix it. Rather than, you didn't take out the garbage, you don't all these, go on and on this way. And so what did the kids learn from that? They learn how to be whatever it is you're telling they are. I have a cousin, he's 2 months older than me. We were students at U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding school, residential school, on an island near Sitka, Alaska, a place called Mount Edgecombe. And he and my sister, one of my younger sisters, they were very adventurous, I'll put it that way. And so they and some others got a hold of some booze and they got drunk. And they got caught. So they were called in into the office. And my sister went in ahead of my cousin, in front of our cousin, Raleigh. And when she came out, she had tear streaks down her face. And she had a big smile on her face, and she said to Cousin Raleigh, cry real hard. So he went in there. He was 17, I think, 16, 17. 17. And they asked him if he did, and he says, yeah. You folks been accusing me of doing all this stuff for so long, it doesn't matter what happens, you keep accusing me, and so I thought, well, if you're going to accuse me, I might as well go and do it. And start crying, and they chased him out. It worked, yeah. So my problem when I got kicked out of the other school where my sisters and my cousin and I were going to that Presbyterian school, I was in trouble all the time. And so my parents and my uncles and aunts, they applied for us to go to the government school. And the recommendation on me was so bad that the school wouldn't take me. So my mother got a hold of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, which was a fairly powerful political organization at the time, and it still is very influential. And she got me accepted into the school. And once I got there, I thought, well, I'm going to behave myself, you know, because I don't like being restricted to my room while everybody else is going to town. I don't like to be out there digging ditches with a shovel for a water line when the other kids are going to town. I don't want to be out there raking rocks off the road while everybody else is going to town, or out there raking leaves out of the flume while everybody else is going to town. I want to do like everybody else. Unfortunately, I'd been branded. And they would not let me change. Something would happen, and even though I wasn't even near, I got blamed. And all they did was they made me mean. And after a while, I just didn't care. I would do the things they were accusing me of. And so that's what really happens a lot of times with kids now, is parents don't listen. Immediately jump to the conclusion he did something wrong or bad. instead of saying, I want to know what happened. And if you listen to them one time, they're going to come tell you again. And see, this is the real tragedy of our form of democracy, is that we're asked one time, what do you really want? We vote, and that's a mandate. You voted, now keep your mouth shut. We're going to carry out this mandate the way we think it should be done. And so that's what we're stuck with. And so that's called democracy. Unfortunately, it goes right back to, I was reading a quote this morning, that the terrible things that were warned about communism, has now happened under capitalism. So, you know, maybe I can change the world. I don't know, but I don't really want to. So I guess I won't. Well, anyway, it's almost time to call it a day and go do other things today. Next week I'll go through some more of this, what I was writing about history and history keepers and what it is we see the world. It's not a utopian world. It's not that at all. It never was. When we talk about the tribal world, we talk about how people lived in harmony. It doesn't say there was no disruptions, there was no disharmony, that there were no criminal acts, as you would want to call them. But people learned how to restore balance. Even a fight, what you call wars, were not wars in the sense of European unconditional surrender. And when you look at the history of what was here before the Europeans arrived, you know, people were clean. People were farming. Many of the world's vegetables, foods, come from here, from what the tribes were growing. You take a look at the cities of Europe. They were much smaller than the ones that were in Mesoamerica. You had cities of 200,000 people. You had aqueducts, you had running water, you had all these things. And they didn't have them in Europe. There was written language that was destroyed. A lot of the books, everything were destroyed. So I think it's time we start looking at our own history and telling ourselves, no, we're good, we're humans. We're entitled to be treated as human and nothing less. So anyway, next week I'll cover some more of that. And by then we'll hear what this Chief Justice was his report on the residential schools. We'll hear about that. And also about the application for a class action suit against the RCMP by 300 former police officers and civilian workers. So anyway, enjoy.
Reconciliation Canada invites you to Reconciliation Matters, an event on May 31st from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
This is a street fair open to all members of the public.
Vancouver at the Sheraton Wall Center.
Also, join Mayor Robertson and other community leaders on June 2nd at SFU Woodward's for a panel discussion on the final report findings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. For more information, visit reconciliationcanada.ca. Last time on CITR, you heard that some kids couldn't afford to enroll in their local YMCA programs.
Oh, no. My God!
But this June 7th, there's Megathon!
Cycle, swim, run, and stretch to raise money for more spaces in YMCA youth programs.
Bam!
Go to www.vanymcamegathon.ca to create, join, or donate to a Megathon team.
Whammo!
On June 7th, be somebody's hero. Wakapa da zoe bam! Wakapa! Bam zoe kapow!
Bam zoe pa waka.
You are cordially invited to Music Waste 2015, the premier celebration of Vancouver's finest local talent. Ha ha ha! 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 Ha ha Music Waves, Vancouver's annual volunteer